May it please the court, good morning. Janice Payne, in August of 1992, was working as an orthopedic nurse on the fourth floor of Clear Lake Hospital in Houston. She was assisting a patient to the bed. The patient was an elderly woman. She started to fall. Janice grabbed her and in the process injured her low back, a soft tissue low back lumbar sprain. That was the injury that began the sequence of events that leads up to this moment in time. Janice was treated by Dr. Green, who is an orthopedist, who gave her a couple weeks of bed rest and prescribed medicine for and some very mild exercises, and then placed her on light duty. She returned to work after a couple weeks. Dr. Green's bill and the bill for the medication was paid for by workers' compensation by Charter Oak, who was the comp carrier for Clear Lake Hospital.
Would you agree, everyone agrees, yes, that the injury occurred in the course and scope of employment for compensability purposes, is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Why should we interpret that differently for exclusivity purposes?
Well, as Justice Maribel pointed out in her consent, I don't feel that the two necessarily are mutually entwined with one another. That if you look at the section of the Comp Act that's been cited by the hospital in its brief, Justice O'Neill, it says that the exclusive remedy of workers' compensation is for work-related injuries. What happened to Janice in the pharmacy downstairs, and what happened as a result of taking 143 days of a drug that said for limited duration use, not to be used for the management of chronic pain, the vasculitis, the demyelinating polyneuropathy, the cataracts on her eyes and being put in a wheelchair for the rest of her life, that injury has nothing to do with what happened on the job in the hospital room on the fourth floor when she caught the patient.
But it's considered to be for compensability purposes, right?
Well, for compensability purposes with regard to the responsibility of Charter Oak to make the workers' compensation benefit payments.
And I guess that's what I'm getting at is the policy argument here.
Correct.
For applying them differently.
Correct. That this court has held that a further injury or disability in the treatment of a compensable injury is in itself compensable. That has to do with compensability. That has to do with Janice's entitlement to workers' compensation benefits vis-a-vis Charter Oak. The question that that this appeal creates for this court is whether under the exclusive remedy provision that says for work-related injuries, you know, whether that phrase has anything to do with Janice Payne's injury that was the basis of her common law negligence action that she filed in Harris County, you know, against the hospital.
Would it have made any difference if the hospital had required her to get her medication from the hospital pharmacy?
I don't know if it would have or not. I know that a question was raised, Justice Hankinson, by the hospital in its brief to this court about cases that involved an employee-only pharmacy. And if she had been required by her employment, as opposed to being given the option, which she was, had been required by her employment to have her workers' compensation prescriptions filled at the hospital pharmacy, from my standpoint, I don't think that would affect what I feel should be the outcome of this case. For the simple reason is that in this case, unlike any that's been cited to this court, you know, this involves an independent act of negligence by the employer that created an independent and separable injury to the employee.
But if that injury occurred in the course and scope of her employment, then it would fall within the exclusivity provision of the comp statute.
If the exclusive remedy provision uses the phrase work-related injury, there is nothing that Janice Payne did in acquiring the Toradol, in taking the Toradol, and in sustaining the injury that is disabled the rest of her life, that in any way relates to her work.
Well, why is she entitled to compensation? And why is she entitled to compensation?
Well, she's entitled to compensation for a few reasons. You know, one is that the holdings of this court that an injury or disability that arises out of the treatment of a compensable injury is also compensable. That has to do with the question of compensability. The second thing is, Justice Heck, that in this case, Charter Oak made the decision as to whether it felt that what put her in intensive care at Clear Lake Hospital, the toxic reaction to the Toradol, related in any way to the treatment for the lumbar strain that was the initial injury.
But you agree with that decision.
Well, I agree with the decision. At the same time, I strongly disagree that her common law rights are left to the whim of a claims adjuster for Charter Oak the workers' compensation insurance carrier, because the Charter Oak had denied that. The Charter Oak had said, wait a minute, we signed on for a low back strain. We signed off on for 2 weeks of light duty. And we are denying that there's a relationship between the ingestion of this drug over 143 days and this horrible life-threatening condition that she now has, and a soft tissue injury that happened 4.5 months ago. If they had made that decision, then there are no workers' compensation benefits that would have been paid for the treatment of that problem, and we're not faced with this situation.
Well, but you would have claimed it.
What would have made the claim on her behalf?
Right.
Had I represented her, she was not represented by an attorney at that time.
And if they had made the right decision, in your view, they would have extended her compensation benefits for this.
Yes, that I feel that the Toradol and the problems it caused are related to the treatment of the injury. So I don't think there's any question about that.
So I'm puzzled to know how it is you think that it's a good, that it's right, that she be entitled to compensation now, but that the employer not be protected by the exclusivity provision.
Okay. That the decision to pay her workers' compensation benefits, and again, the decision that I agree with the correct one, and the payment of workers' compensation benefits has to do with compensability, that issue. But then when you fast forward to that section of the Act that's been cited, you know, having to do with exclusivity, where it says this is the exclusive remedy, you know, for work-related injuries. You know, that's where we part company. This injury, I don't think, is work-related, and therefore, so this case subject to the exclusive provisions of the Workers' Compensation Act, because a claims adjuster made that call.
Let me explore this with you and see if it answers the question.
Yes, sir.
Based upon Texas case law, this second injury is considered to be compensable, because it was concerning the ongoing treatment of an injury that occurred in the course and scope of employment. Correct?
Yes, sir.
So far? Now, in response to Justice O'Neill a second ago, you said that the second injury was in the course and scope of her employment. Is that what you intended to say?
No, the second injury was a compensable injury for the purposes of her receiving workers' compensation benefits from Charter Oak.
And that's based upon Texas legal precedent.
Yes, sir.
But isn't it true, or is it your position, that the second injury, even though it's compensable, was not in the course and scope of her employment?
Correct.
And because it was not in the course and scope of her employment, that's why it's not subject to the workers' compensation.
That's the distinction I feel between this case and any case that's been decided by this court before. All the cases that have been cited to the court with regard to the issue we are now discussing, Justice Abbott, you know, have to do, like Derenberg and the God May case, you know, have to do with a new and independent tort, where the doctor misdiagnosed the wrist fracture, where the doctor misdiagnosed the hepatitis B, okay? A new and independent tort. All of the cases have to do with, like the Gonzalez or Sutherland cases, where there was a new and independent injury. It was the same tort, the same incident, but a new and independent injury. But what pain does is combine both, where there's a new and independent tort, the negligence of the hospital pharmacist, and there's a new independent inseparable injury, and that is the vasculitis that Stevens Johnson syndrome. Just put her in a wheelchair.
Well, has she gone to Eckerd's as opposed to the hospital pharmacy, and the same thing happened? The injury, you contend, would still be compensable,
right,
because it was ongoing treatment, but she would nevertheless have a common law cause of action against Eckerd's.
That's correct.
And what you're saying is that the pharmacy here is in the same shoes as Eckerd's.
Yes, sir. And actually, that analysis is going to be taken a step further. If she were an Eckerd's employee, if she heard her back stop in the shower, that's where the injury came from, and she went back to Eckerd's to fill Dr. Green's prescription for the Toradol, then where we presently are in this case, she doesn't have a common law remedy against Eckerd's, because the Court of Appeals in the pain case has held, you know, that it meets the test of compensability and exclusivity.
Mr. Waldner,
yes,
if in fact she's compensated for the second injury under workman's comp,
yes,
if she were to be compensated and then we were to permit her to sue under common law, would she be then, are we, would we be allowing her to then recover possibly twice for her injuries?
No, sir. I would, Justice Gonzalez, I would refer you to the Dena versus Ferreira case that was decided by this court a few years ago. In that case, the majority opinion, it was discussed as to whether under the workers' compensation statute, the workers' compensation carrier, Charter Oak in this case, would have a right to subrogation against the employer, because the statute says when the employee brings a cause of action against third parties. And then the discussion of the majority opinion in the Medina case said that well, is the employer a third party? You know, is it for certain that the workers' compensation insurance carrier would have a subrogation right when the so-called third party is the employer? And that was discussed by the majority. I don't think that issue was ever resolved. But in his dissent, Justice Enum, in his dissent, pointed out that A, it wasn't an issue that was resolved by the majority, and B, under those circumstances, even if it were resolved, that the usual statutory right of subrogation that the workers' compensation insurance carrier would have does not exist when the quote third party is the employer, that certainly Charter Oak would have a right to equitable subrogation under those circumstances. Either way, Charter Oak gets reimbursed for its expenditures in the event that Jazz Pain is successful in a common law action against the hospital.
And isn't that one of the problems with the respondent's argument, is it would cut off those subrogation rights?
Correct. And I don't think it would. I think the right of subrogation is there by statute. And if not, as Justice Enix said in his dissent in the Medina case, it certainly is there by equity.
But what she's saying is, if you don't get to prevail, it cuts off the subrogation rights of the subrogor.
Correct. Right. Charter Oak would have no right to subrogation if this case stays in its present status. And the last thing I'd like to address, very briefly, is that one of the arguments that has been made in the motion for summary judgment, in the briefing before the Court of Appeals, and in the briefing before this court, is that Janice Payne, in essence, wants to have her cake and eat it too. You know, she wants to be protected by workers' compensation, and she wants to preserve her common law remedies. Well, I will point out to this court that argument cuts both ways with regard to the hospital. Charter Oak is a workers' compensation insurance carrier. That's the product that's sold to this hospital. That's what the hospital paid for with regard to the premiums to Charter Oak. Charter Oak signed on for the back strain that happened on the fourth floor. That's what they signed on for. Now, if you assume under the rules that this court has decided to do with the review of summary judgment, that everything we've alleged is true, Janice was hurt. She was hurt seriously. She was hurt as a result of negligence by the pharmacist at the hospital, and that she's totally and permanently disabled as a result of those injuries. If you make all those assumptions for the purpose of the review, of the summary judgment, then what's happened is that the hospital, through its workers' compensation carrier, has gotten over $1 million. That's the figure they cite, as to the present level of benefits. It's cost that much to take care of Janice. They've gotten over $1 million of professional liability coverage from the workers' compensation insurance carrier. I think that's having their cake and eating it too also.
Well, but I'm still puzzled. You think they owe that money?
I think
that they owe it to the plaintiff.
An opportunity to pursue a common law action, Justice Hackett, that yes, they owe that to Janice with the subrogation rights of Charter Oak intact. Yes, sir, I did. And one of the phrases that goes through all the cases that are discussed in both of our briefs, it has to do with this delicate balance that is the workers' compensation scheme in the state. A delicate balance of rights, compromise, obligations, and things of that nature. Well, the delicacy of that balance is tremendously upset. When a workers' compensation insurance carrier, has to pay for the professional liability sins of its insurer, which at the same time extinguishes any possibility of subrogation, that all of that is upset. It's also upset when the common law rights of a citizen like Janice Payne are abridged or determined, at least, by a claims adjuster for the comp carrier. The election of remedies argument and the affirmative defense of that that's also included in the brief does not apply because of the first criterion this court established in the Bocanegra case.
Well, but I keep having trouble. Even if the adjuster hadn't made that decision for Ms. Payne, she would have claimed benefits and thought she was entitled to them.
She would have claimed under workers' compensation?
Uh-huh.
Yes, sir.
So what difference does it make that the adjuster did it himself?
Right.
I'm not following what difference it makes.
Well, the thing is this. Janice Payne is an employee of Clear Lake Hospital. My good friend and colleague, Shannon Ratliff, mentioned a phrase during his argument, you know, and that had to do with intellectual honesty. The intellectual honesty in this case would have to do with analyzing this case in the real world. Janice was covered by workers' compensation in the hospital period. Janice was also covered by benefit of her employment, you know, by major medical coverage. If Janice, when she woke up a month later from the ICU, if Janice at that time had, if the comp carrier had denied, said there's no nexus between the Toradol and the Baxter, and she now is being covered in her hospital, all of her treatment is being paid for by her major medical care, you know, at that point. I seriously doubt that Janice Payne or any responsible individual who may later represent her would be pushing the workers' compensation aspect of that under those circumstances.
But if she needed the coverage, she would have asked for it, and in your view, she would have been entitled.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
Mr. Sheehy? Would you agree that there's no way it can be argued that this injury she incurred as a result of the Toradol was work-related or incurred in the course and scope of employment?
Sorry, I may have gotten mixed up a little bit in the negatives, but I agree that the Toradol reaction is considered work-related or deemed work-related for purposes of the compensation statute.
Compensation, but what about the exclusivity provision?
Same thing, and because compensability and exclusivity of remedy are coextensive by definition.
Well, you answered part of the question. It's compensable, but are you saying that the second injury was in the course and scope of her employment?
What I am saying is the definition of compensability is an injury that is suffered in the course and scope of employment. That's the definition of compensability.
Well, that's one definition. However, with regard to ongoing treatment, Texas law has said that ongoing treatment is compensable, but ongoing treatment has not been defined to be within the course and scope of employment, has it?
Justice Abbott, that's my point, is that once this court holds, and I think properly so, that the subsequent injury is compensable, you go to the definition of compensability in the statute. And the statute says that a compensable injury is an injury that's suffered in the course and scope of employment. So the subsequent reaction to the Toradol is deemed, as a matter of law, to be suffered in the course and scope of employment. If it's not, it's not compensable.
But if on these facts, let's put aside the back injury. She being a hospital employee, was allowed to get her prescriptions at the pharmacy. And she got this prescription from the Toradol from her physician. She goes to the hospital pharmacy, and she gets it filled. Is that an injury, and she has the drug reaction? Is that an injury in the course and scope of employment?
I'm sorry, did you take out the back injury? She
yes,
was not injured
I did.
At first.
She's using the hospital pharmacy. They're giving her this drug that she has a reaction to. Is that an injury that she suffered in the course and scope of her employment?
Judges have long memories, and there may be a time when I come before you and argue that point. But the point is, I think under those circumstances, it would not be compensable because it was not suffered in the course and scope.
It's not a course and scope injury.
That's right. And in Beaumar, there was a footnote that said, well, there may be circumstances in which an injury may not be compensable, but yet also may be subject to the exclusive remedy provision. My point is that if an injury is itself compensable, it must be subject to the exclusive remedy provision.
Regardless of what other conduct, even let's change the facts a little bit again, that the second injury in this instance, the taking of the drug, is caused by a third party. It's not a course and scope again if you look at it separately, but it's compensable under Texas law because it's a drug reaction in connection with a drug taken for a work-related injury. Does she have a claim against the third party?
Certainly, just like she did here against the doctor and the drug company.
Well, if the action of the employer in this instance is like an action of a third party, and it's not something that is an action that occurs in the course and scope, why should that action be protected under the exclusivity provision of the statute?
Two reasons. Number one, it's the employer, and that's what the statute says. And number two, Your Honor, I disagree that it is not considered in the course and scope of employment if it's a because, even if it's given by a third party, it is still considered in the course and scope of employment by definition, because they're compensable. And the definition of compensable in the statute says an injury is compensable essentially if it's suffered in the course and scope of employment.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Okay, and this court, I think rightfully so, has said we are going to deem the subsequent injuries to be compensable. So if we deem them to be compensable, we have to deem them to be within the course and scope of employment. Because if you don't, then it's not compensable and she doesn't get the benefits.
Now, this truly might not be compensable. I mean, there is a sort of a hiatus here, both temporally and causally and philosophically, that at least raises the question that this might not be compensable.
Justice Heck, I say, number one, that we all agree that it is. So whether this court ought to go down that road, I don't know. We certainly have never raised in the courts below that it is not. And I also think, if we look at precedent, that we would probably have to overrule some prior precedent in order to get to that point. You know, poor Mr. Sutherland, who had a bad day, he gets hurt, he gets put on a table, he falls off, and he gets hurt again. We've got somebody else who takes a drug in the Gonzalez case. We've got Nurse Macias, who, because of physical therapist, causes problems. So where do you draw the line to say that this subsequent medical conduct is somehow so separate from the prior that we don't consider compensable? And I'm not sure where we draw the line. I think that if we are honest to precedent here, and if we want to stay with the liberal approach toward the workers' compensation statute, I would have a difficult time arguing that the reaction to the Toradol is not compensable. Perhaps I would have liked to have done it 5 years ago.
Why should the insurance carrier's right to equitable subordination be cut off on this fact pattern when it would not be cut off if Eckerd's or another third-party pharmacy had provided the medication rather than the hospital pharmacy?
But I don't see a break there. I think that the hospital insurance carrier is going to have its right of subrogation to compensation benefits that it paid. That's the compensation carrier's battle. If Eckerd's pays it and the plaintiff can sue Eckerd's, then the carrier can go in and get the money from Eckerd's.
But in this case, the carrier is paying. But because we're cutting off, you're asking us to cut off her right to sue the hospital pharmacy on a common law negligence claim.
Correct.
There will be no common law negligence claim, and therefore, where there could be a potential recovery of damages, and therefore the carrier has no basis for asserting equitable subrogation rights.
The carrier cannot assert subrogation rights against the hospital. That's correct.
Well,
now,
why should the employer then be able to escape that piece of it, and the carrier's equitable subordination rights be cut off for an independent tort just because they happen to be the employer, when in fact had it been another pharmacy that did it, same course of conduct, they're subrogated because we know that we have a separate tort that's been committed?
Where we disagree is just because it's the employer. The employer paid workers' compensation premiums.
But the employer didn't pay premiums for professional liability coverage under this particular policy, and the alleged bad act is an allegation of professional negligence by the hospital pharmacy.
But it's covered. Whether you call it professional negligence or whatever, it's covered. And once it's covered, that's why the hospital pays its premiums. But Justice Hankinson, this happens all the time. How often do we have a situation where the employer is negligent, which causes the injury? It happens all the time in workers' comp. And what the legislature has said is, I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to give the employee quick recovery in exchange for not having to prove negligence.
But that's when that
is in the course and scope situation.
But this is where I'm not being very articulate about it is, if it is compensable, it must be in the course and scope, by definition, because that's what the statute says. Now, the courts have deemed these subsequent injuries to be compensable. They have said, this court and others have said, okay, what we're going to do, we're going to say, because of the liberal construction of the statute, we're going to say that these subsequent injuries are, in fact, compensable.
Let me ask you this.
As a matter of policy.
Let me ask you this. If we say that the second injury here was not in the course and scope, what case law would we be inconsistent with?
If you say it is not in the course and scope,
the second
Your Honor,
it's compensable, but not within course and scope.
You're violating the statute. 401.011, the definition of compensability.
But we would not be inconsistent with any case law.
Certainly. I think all the case law that has allowed recovery for the employee against the workers' compensation carrier for subsequent injuries. Because the only way that the carrier has the obligation to pay workers' compensation benefits is if the injury is compensable.
Well, Mr. Sheehy, you say that's statutory, but isn't that actually case decisions that say the subsequent injury, because it arises, is the result of having received treatment in the cases that said that's compensable? It's not the statute that says compensable. Cases said that if this is something that arises out of the treatment that was required from an injury in the course and scope, that's also compensable.
Justice Keenan, that's right, except that only goes to the first half we all agree on, which is compensability. We all agree that it goes to compensability.
I'm sorry, maybe I'm not being clear. You say that goes to the first half. You're arguing that compensability is synonymous with exclusivity because of the statutory definition.
That's right.
And then you make the next step and say, since a subsequent injury that arises out of the treatment is compensable, it therefore arises out of the course and scope. And you say that's because of the statute in answer to the question of what would be contrary. But that other step is really decisional law, not statutory, isn't it?
I don't think so. Let me try quickly to walk through it. The way it makes sense to me. The definition of compensability in the statute is an injury that is suffered in the course and scope of employment. That's what the statute says in terms of the definition. The exclusivity provision says we are not going to allow you to sue for a work-related injury. The two of them, to me, I don't understand how a...
Well, my question is wrong then, I guess. Where, in answer to the question about what would be inconsistent with our previous decisions to say that this subsequent injury was not in the course and scope, you said would be contrary to a statute, and you started to cite a provision. The statute says nothing about a subsequent injury that arises out of treatment for an injury that occurred, but that's case law. Now, isn't that the answer, that it was that second step you take is the result of case decisions that have said this subsequent injury is compensable because it would not have occurred but for the original treatment that was being required because of that injury that was occurring in the course of scope?
There is no question that it is case law that provides us the law that says the subsequent injury for treatment of a work-related injury is work-related, is compensable. That the medical treatment for a compensable injury, complications arising from the medical treatment for a compensable injury, is compensable.
And because of the case law, that leads you to the conclusion that if an employee, a co-employee, is the one who is responsible for that second injury, the employer is still protected by the exclusivity because of the decisions of the courts that have brought have extended compensability to cover what would otherwise have been considered not a work-related injury.
That's correct, but let's go a step further. If your honors decide that you want to reverse prior precedent and hold that the subsequent injuries are not compensable, that's fine. But what we are doing is we are limiting, in other cases, the scope of recovery for injured employees. And if you want to make that policy decision that you want to go get away from that, and say, in this case, Janice Payne would not be entitled to workers' compensation benefits for subsequent injuries, that is certainly within the purview of this court to do. In talking with Justice Hecht a few moments ago, I had mentioned that's not a path that we have chosen to take, either side has chosen to take in this case. We all agree that that prior law ought to remain in effect. That is, that the reaction to the Torah law is compensable. We start with that. Now, I think where we're having a disconnect is you are saying that, yes, this court can change that rule, which undercuts what I'm talking about in terms of exclusivity of remedy. And that's true, because I think that if this court decides that an injury is not compensable, I have a much tougher argument saying that it's subject to the exclusive remedy provision. Because if she didn't get any benefits for the Toradol, reaction to the Toradol, I have a little tougher road to go to say the insurance carrier didn't pay her comp, and she also shouldn't be allowed to sue us, because I don't think that's what the statute says. I think what the statute says is, if you pay comp, because you only pay comp for work-related injuries, by definition, that's what a compensable injury is.
Well, but if it were a third party, again, to follow up on Justice Hankinson's question, if it were a third party who filled the prescription, it would still be compensable.
Certainly. That's right.
But she could still sue the third party.
She certainly could. But here, she went to the employer. And this happens all the time in cases. This legislature has decided that the employer is going to be protected from common law causes of action if its insurance carrier pays comp. And was it bad luck for her, and I don't mean that facetiously, for her to go, nobody expected obviously this to happen. Had she gone to another pharmacy not related to the hospital, would she be allowed to sue? Certainly. And in this case, remember, she was able to sue the doctor, which she did. She was able to sue the drug company, which she did. She had those claims. But, Your Honor, you know from your prior legal experience and litigation experience, there are a lot of cases where something happens due to the negligence or the wrongful conduct of the employer where the employee has no remedy except comp. Sometimes that happens.
No, I'm just saying there's a disconnect, I think, between your argument on compensability. Your argument doesn't fit if it's a third party where she filled the prescription.
Because the third party isn't the employer. And because the third party isn't the employer, there's no bar by the exclusive remedy provision.
No, but I understood your argument to be that because it followed up from the original injury, it was compensable.
Correct. I think in the holdings of this court, that's correct.
Right. And the fact that it's a third-party employer, I mean a third-party tortfeasor, doesn't affect the compensability piece. And my understanding is you're trying to equate those two.
No. She is able to, the injury in terms of comp is compensable whether she fills the prescription at the hospital or if she fills it from a third party. It's compensable. The hospital's workers' compensation carrier has to pay benefits. No doubt about that. We don't just, in another case we might, but at least in this case we do not. We all agree compensation is due. But the next question is, and I understand the thought, well, if she went to a third party, she'd be able to sue that third party. But she can't sue the hospital because the hospital is her employer. That's correct, because that's what the statute says.
Here's the point she's making, though, that I think creates some inconsistency in your argument. You're saying compensability equates to exclusivity.
No. I'm sorry that I misspoke. What I'm saying is, in terms of the employer, limited to the employer, if a injury is compensable under the workers' compensation statute, the employee may not sue the employer. That is, if an injury is compensable, the employer is immune from suit. Anytime the injury is compensable, the plaintiff cannot sue the employer. I didn't mean to say that the plaintiff could not sue a third party if an injury is compensable. Certainly they could. And when I said there was a connection to it, I meant only in terms of the employer. Certainly, regardless of who provides the drug, which pharmacy, be it the hospital or another one, it's compensable. She could sue the third party, the Eckerds of the world, because the exclusive remedy provision doesn't bar her from doing that. But Section 408.001 of the Labor Code says the employer is immune from suit for work-related injuries. So, if you look at the two definitions, and this is, I'm trying to do this in logical order and I wasn't very good at it. Step one, the injury is compensable. We agree to that in this case, that the subsequent reaction to the Toradol is compensable, has to be paid by the carrier. Because it's compensable, be it because this court has made a policy decision that it's compensable, but because it's compensable, you look to the statute, and the statute says compensability means an injury suffered in the course and scope of employment. This court, and I think rightfully so, has said we are going to deem as a matter of law, as a matter of policy in this state, that subsequent injury to be sustained in the course and scope of employment, because if you don't do that, then it's not compensable and the employee doesn't get paid.
That's the disconnect.
So,
I have a hard time.
But step two, but it has to be, by definition, because...
It sounds like what you're saying is because it's compensable and because it's the employer, it's exclusive.
That's right.
Okay.
Because it's compensable, the statute, the definition of compensability says suffered in the course and scope of employment. So we have to assume, we have to deem as a matter of law that this Toradol reaction was sustained in the course and scope of employment. Because if we don't, it's not compensable.
Ms. Sheehy, does she now file a second workers' compensation claim on a second injury?
On the Toradol?
Yes.
It's been paid?
There's one issue where they're paying the medical benefits to her because that's arising out of the injury that was otherwise being treated, but I assume that she now has permanent total disability that is a different level of compensation than the low back strain that was originally calculated when she made the comp claim.
My friend Paul Waldner will probably, I don't think it's in the record, but my understanding.
I'm just asking how this works. The argument of the exclusivity is because of the benefits that are otherwise payable, but when the courts extended the compensability to cover the treatment arising out of a second injury that was not the work-related deal, but it's because the treatment resulted out of that, the argument that's being made is it's by definition a work-related injury. Well, this one produces a different disability. So by backtracking under the compensation provision, our decision to say that the exclusivity provision applies, it's anonymous compensability, we have a second injury, the employee caused it. Well, that only answers part of the question. What now happens? Is there, by that, you just have a new compensation
she
claim
gets
that has
the compensation
benefits
for the subsequent injury, which I think she has. But yeah, certainly, she's entitled to those damages or those injuries. And it's, excuse me, I'm going to have 10 more seconds, because I don't want to forget the next step. When I was talking about compensability equaling injuries suffered in the course and scope of employment, then you go to the exclusive remedy provision of the statute, which says you can't sue the employer if it's work-related. So since the two definitions, compensability and the exclusivity of remedy, all deal with work-related, it cannot be compensable and at the same time not subject to the exclusive remedy provision as far as the employer is concerned. We request that the judgment of the Court of Appeals be affirmed.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Walden, this is a statutory scheme, is that correct?
The workers' compensation aspect is, yes, ma'am.
And so when courts are deciding what's covered and what's not, we look to the statute.
Well, the court would look at the statute, but in response to some questions that Justice Enoch was asking, that the statute has to do with workers' compensation. That portion of this case having to do with extending compensability to injuries or disability caused by the treatment, you know, that has been made by the courts. In
right, but the court has no authority to make law apart from the statute, is that correct?
That's correct.
So when we said in our case law that subsequent injuries are compensable, we, by virtue of the statute, also were concluding that they were work-related.
Well, I think that the conclusion that would come from those decisions is that they were compensable.
Well, where would this court get the authority to say they're not work-related, but they're nevertheless compensable? Where do we get the statutory authority to say that when the statute says only work-related injuries are compensable?
Well, I'm not sure I understand your question.
Where do we get the statutory authority to say it's compensable but it's not work-related?
Well, it's right there in the definitions. You know, because the legislature, if they wanted to make these two things, compensability and exclusivity, you know, mutually inclusive.
How do they define compensability?
Well, for compensability, they say a compensable injury means an injury that arises out of and in the course and scope of employment for which compensation is payable under this subtitle.
Where does this court get the authority to say that compensability is anything other than that definition?
Well, I'm not suggesting that compensability is anything other than what it says right here in 401.011 subsection 10.
So it's in the course and scope and it's work-related.
Yes, ma'am. That's what compensability is defined under the statute as being.
Okay, so it's work-related and in the course and scope.
Right.
Why is it also excluded under exclusivity provision? They also use course and scope?
No, they don't use course and scope, and they don't use compensability. If the court were to look at 408.001, it says recovery of workers' compensation benefits is the exclusive remedy of an employee for a work-related injury sustained.
Okay, that's my point. Where do we get the authority to say, on the one hand, it's compensable but not work-related, when necessarily under the statute it has to be work-related to be compensable?
Well, I think if I understand your question correctly, Justice Owen, I think is right there in the statute, because I think we're talking about two different things. One having to do with the circumstances under which an injury is compensable under the workers' compensation statute. That is the right of an employee to obtain workers' compensation benefits. That's compensability.
It's not work-related, it's not compensable. Is that correct?
Well, I'm saying that if it's compensable, that's between the workers' compensation carrier and the employee, and that has to do with course and scope issues. That's what the definition says. Now, when you go forward to the exclusivity provision, now that doesn't say course and scope, and it doesn't say compensability. It says work-related injury, and that's where Mr. Sheehy and I part company, because with regard to the exclusivity portion of the Workers' Compensation Act, if the legislature wanted to say if it's compensable, then it's exclusive, all they had to do was say that. But that's not what they chose to do.
So I understand how you think they fit. You think this injury was in the course and scope of employment, but was not work-related.
I think, to take it just one step further, Justice Sack, I don't think this injury was in the course and scope of the employment as defined by the statute. As the decisions from the Texas courts have extended it in the so-called extension cases, where an injury that arises out of the medical treatment of a compensable injury also being compensable.
Where do we get the authority to extend the statute, as you say? Where does this court have the authority to, quote, extend the statute?
I'm not asking the statute be extended.
Well, you just said that that's what we did.
Well,
where do we get the authority to do that?
I don't know. I guess that the answer to that would be with the justices and the courts of appeals and the predecessors of your honors, who wrote those decisions. And I'm not trying to be flippant. I don't know where to go other than that, Your Honor. And to answer very briefly something that Justice Heck brought up about this might not be compensable. Well, as I understood that question, it's like if the tort all doesn't relate to her problems, you know, if the treatment that put Janice, in the hospital that made her so ill, if that doesn't relate to her back strain, then why would they be paying the workers' compensation benefits? Why would that happen? I think that if this isn't correct, to give the common law rights, back to employees for a new and independent tort that causes a new and independent injury, then there's a bad situation where it's ripe for collusion between the comp carrier. I'm not suggesting that happened in this case, but it's ripe for collusion between the comp carrier and the employee, because the employer, all they have to do is tell their workers' compensation insurance carrier, start paying the bills on this. She's still in intensive care. Pay those bills, and we have limited our liability to workers' compensation, and we don't have any liability for common law cause of action.
But you could have rejected the workers' comp and said, no, I have common law rights, and made that election.
At the time the workers' compensation benefits were accepted and being paid to her, she was in intensive care with endotracheal tubes.
But you haven't rejected the comp payments. You're not rejecting. You want them both. You want comp payments and your common law rights.
Want the comp payments and the common law right to pursue. If successful, the money goes back to Charter Oak. Not both. Janice Payne will never have both in her pocket because of the Workers' Compensation Act and the subrogation rights of Charter Oak.
Any other questions? Thank you,
counsel. Thank you very much.
That concludes the second argument. The court will take another brief recess.